The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I have with me Alva Smith, campaigner, Daniel Murray, political correspondent with the Business Post. Daniel, I'll start with you because there is a lot of speculation, some of which undoubtedly you will be adding to tomorrow in your own writings in the Business Post, in relation to the cabinet reshuffle. If you are Simon Harris and you are facing 18 months maximum-ish, thereabouts, before the next general election, and you have a relatively limited group to select, or rather, a limited group of options for seats because the cabinet that FG has is now relatively small, what are the factors you have to weigh up?
Yeah, well, I mean, ordinarily you have to be a kind of a mathematical genius to try and figure out the various combinations and permutations of cabinet, possible cabinet reshuffles. In this instance, it's slightly better in that we're limited to just the seven Fine Gael ministers. And of those, there's three or four of them that are probably fairly safe to definitely stay in cabinet and probably to stay in their places. Harris himself is due to be elected Taoiseach in just over a week's time. After that, he will have to reappoint the entire cabinet. Fianna Fáil and the Greens, of course, they will all just be reappointed under agreement with the coalition leaders. And amongst his Fine Gael ministers, there's a couple of people who are in the firing line on the front page of The Independent this morning. The two names that have been circulating, Simon Coveney, Helen McEntee, at risk. Simon Coveney, it was rumoured for a while that Simon Coveney's own political career might be coming to an end and that he might step down after the next election. Now, last week, just as before Simon Harris was elected leader of Fine Gael, Simon Coveney at this party convention gave a kind of rip-roaring performance where he made it very clear he was running again in the next election. And that has made things more difficult for Harris, because if he does decide to demote him, possibly he's making the decision about Coveney's political career and whether or not he does run again. Now, also, you know, it's a family tradition with Coveney, so possibly he wants to be in politics for life. We're all assuming that just because he's reached the end of a particular political cycle, 13 years as a cabinet minister, that he'd want out. And of course, we have to remember that Coveney is the last of that old guard. Varadkar and Coveney were the last of the ministerial Fine Gael ministers who were there in 2011. The other interesting one is Helen McEntee. I don't think there's a suggestion of her being dropped out of cabinet, but there's some suggestion of her being rotated into another cabinet position out of the Justice Ministry.
Like what?
Yeah. I mean, maybe higher education, which is where Harris was himself. This is when you get into the permutations and combinations and who's for the up and who's for the down. The last person I'll mention as potentially at risk is Hildegard Nocton, who is the party chief whip. And if there were three, and of course we have to remember Varadkar is on his way out of cabinet. So if there's three new cabinet positions possibly available, then there's three that possibly will get the step up. And I think Harris probably has a few people in mind for that as well.
If Coveney goes, what of Cork? That would leave them with nobody in cabinet representing either Cork City or Cork County. In fact, nobody in Munster, wouldn't it?
Well, nobody in Fine Gael representing it, but of course you'd have Micheál Martin and Michael McGrath. You'd be removing just one of three very senior ministers. But look, that's obviously not a consideration for Fine Gael itself, who does have to consider, you know, Harris does have to consider geographical spread. There's a risk, you know, that him replacing Varadkar, that again, it's seen as a very Dublin-centric kind of a party with a Dublin-centric leadership. So that'll be important. But look, there are other non-Dublin possibilities as well, the likes of Peter Burke being appointed to cabinet. I think Burke being tipped possibly for a justice role. Another one, Neil Richmond, who is a Dublin TD, who could just take the easy step up from junior in the Department of Enterprise into Simon Coveney's role as the Enterprise Minister. And that's an important thing to consider as well, because continuity, even though Harris will want to shake things up a bit, continuity is also important. There's 1 year max left in this government. Too much of a shake-up, too many new ministers into new briefs where they have 12 months to read themselves into their briefs before they're kicked out.
I absolutely agree with that. And I think what may actually happen is that he'll move one, but not both of them. Mm. Which one it'll be, I don't know. I think he might want to move McEntee. But he may decide to leave her and move Coveney. But Coveney, of course, is not to be shifted. It struck me as soon as, or he doesn't want to be, as soon as I read about his performance, I thought, my gosh, that's that regeneration. He sees an opportunity, because he did say that he had his last shot at leadership. I don't believe that for one single minute. If he stays
in... You think Simon Coveney still has leadership aspirations?
Well, you know, he's not that old. Many things happen in politics. I think that there's a real possibility, and he's clearly got this kind of energy mojo, I think you call it, going again now. And he's off there and he's on a canter and he's basically, he's standing there, well, he's standing
you
up
like
to
this
Harris.
Text. Harris know? Would be mad to demote Coveney. He will easily win a seat in Cork as, wait for it, it's heresy, as an independent.
As an independent, there you are. But the other thing that did occur to me when I was, you know, reading these endlessly over the past few days about who'd be moved and who'd be put where, and I kept seeing this image of the Titanic and the deck chairs. And I thought, you know, really, we have to be sensible about this and say this is less than a year that Harris has. And actually, if he has any sense at all, as my grandmother used to say, if he has a titter of it, he leave them be and motor on now as quickly as he possibly can. Right?
Well, I want a view on this, Daniel, because we spoke to last weekend to both Frank Flannery, the Fine Gael strategist, and then Francis Fitzgerald, former Thornish, that was here on the panel. And both of them talked about energy, that Simon Harris was going to be energetic. That would really mix things up. Was going to be energetic. Yeah. What difference does it make? If you do put in two or three new ministers into briefs where they are flung into something in which they have no expertise, is it enough that they look shiny and fresh? Does that give a bounce?
I think it can give a bounce, and but it's purely an electoral strategy as opposed to it giving any kind of fresh zest to the government in its final year. The danger is that Simon Harris, with the possibility that Fine Gael after the next election could be heading for the opposition benches, just purely on the basis that they've been in power, they will have been in power for 14 years at that stage. A big risk facing Harris is that he's seen as a lame duck Taoiseach, and there's a risk when you appoint new people to cabinet that they're seen as lame duck ministers, you know, sitting in their briefs for less than 12 months. And that maybe is a risk that he'll have to take into account. I think the energy matters. It matters in the Taoiseach's office who's in there, because it is a role which requires very intense energy. And Harris certainly has no lack of that. And certainly when you have a kind of a new look Taoiseach, it makes sense from a political point of view to want to shake things up on your front bench to give a sense of this is a new generation of Fine Gael. We're going to do things different. But again, Harris is limited in that if it was a majority Fine Gael government for the next year, Harris could announce new policies to beat the band and have a budget, giveaway budget and all that kind of stuff. But he's not. He's in a three-party coalition, and anything that is agreed has to be agreed with the other coalition leaders. And if Harris and his ministers come along with things that look like kite flying ahead of an election, he's going to be slapped down very quickly.
The other thing is the electorate are not particularly keen on seeing a lot of changes happening. What they want to see is delivery on, you know, policy promises that have been made and not kept. And so, you know, I think that there is strategically an argument not to make changes, to say we're sitting tight here, we are actually going to implement and we're going to pass as much legislation with as much expert and experienced ministers as we can muster to actually deliver. And that is where the energy is going.
Well, that goes to a thing I want your view on, Ava, which is where you talk about the delivery. One of the big issues that we know about is housing is one, immigration is the other, and the two to some extent intertwine. And a story in The Independent today saying that 16 TDs in dodging social media debates ahead of European and local polls. This is TDs who have had people on social media question them or criticise them in respect of immigration, and they have refused to engage at all. And the next page, system at breaking point, 6,000 stuck in direct provision.
Absolutely. I mean, the situation is just getting simply worse and worse every day. And what is very distressing and I think very depressing is quite clearly TDs, 60% of them sitting on the wings saying, well, this is not something we want to address or talk about because we'll get scolded, we'll get burnt, we'll get burnt. We've all been scolded, those of us who are on social media over the, you know, past whatever. And public representatives are, in a sense, in the firing line. But I do think that they have a responsibility to participate via social media in one of the most central debates that we have in front of us today. It shouldn't even be a debate, actually.
Is it fear that they're being trolled into?
Of course it is. It's fear. And we notice that when you read through the articles a bit more, that a lot of these TDs, they will comment when it's in their own communities. They will stand up and say, well, you know, I'm against this or I'm for that or I support the other, depending on what their politics are. But they are not coming out and contributing to the overall sense of what are the actions that we need to take? What are the solutions that we need to find in order to welcome, to house, to integrate people who are coming here, who are fleeing persecution, who are fleeing war, who are fleeing terrible poverty elsewhere. So that it is a standing back from the issue. That's what it is. It is not just about social media. This is politicians effectively refusing to deal with a hugely important issue.
But is part of that, Alva, because what they are seeing is a rising cohort of people who do not want what they are seeing happening, and that the politicians don't really have much of a way to convince them?
Well, I think you still have to stick with it. I know that how difficult it is. I don't, you know, get anything like the kind of abuse that elected representatives get. But you still know, I still know from my activist life, that you have in a way to kind of rise above that and to say, I am going to go on making my straightforward, honest, well thought out, important points about this. I am not going to let myself be intimidated. So that there is a sort of giving into it by saying silence is a way of giving in. And I think that we need a lot more resistance to the hatred and the cyber violence that we're seeing at the moment. I understand that women in particular have been getting a terribly bad role. So we do need also much better control, much better legislation around social media. Of course we do. But it really depresses me when I read an article of this kind to think that, you know, this issue is dividing our country. We need our elected representatives to get in there and to say, this is what we're thinking, this is what we're doing.
Is it effectively, Daniel, is there a cohort now almost disenfranchised? Is there a cohort who believe that the political system doesn't listen to their views because it fundamentally believes their views to be reprehensible?
I think there is, especially on this issue. But I do think leaders are meant to lead. I mean, the way some political parties are behaving on this issue makes me think of that phrase, you know, there go the people, I must follow them for I am their leader. You know, that is not what leaders are meant to do. And particularly on an issue like this, it requires politicians to be brave. Sometimes it is unpopular, but a huge amount of the fears that are out there are being driven by mis and disinformation, you know, and that's very calculated in some parts by a small cohort, but it's very effective because of social media and a lot of people, you know, and I know people in my own life who certainly you see these kind of views filtering down from the most extreme level to much more.
But are people being ignored even when it isn't related to mis and disinformation? There are people who will say, look, I think that we have, as a nation, taken in, quotes, too many people. I'm concerned about the local hotel no longer functioning as a hotel. I'm concerned that the cafes that used to do well because there'd be people staying for a night or whatever else are no longer surviving. Those kind of concerns, do you get the sense that they are being sidelined and ignored? Is there an open ear to them?
I don't think they're being sidelined and ignored, but I think sometimes when those concerns are raised, what's ignored is the wider global context that we're operating in, which is that immigration is on the rise for all kinds of reasons. Wars around the world, climate change is going to make it worse. And we've seen record numbers of immigrants come into this country in the last number of years, not for any massive pull factors that we've done here, but because it's something that's happening everywhere and all across Europe. Only last week this week we saw the Irish government opt into a major reform of EU migration rules, and that's in recognition of the fact that this is something that is happening in every single country. So it's about taking a compassionate approach to issues like this as opposed to stoking fear and then I think getting these kind of reactionary positions.
I think that is true about, you know, we are now beginning to have to take our share in the European context, and it's also true that we're having to deal with the far-right extremism, which is, you know, rampant and accelerating throughout the rest of Europe, and which is really hitting us very badly, and we have to take a stand. And I think that goes back to my point, that to remain silent in the face of that is really to allow that to simply happen and to continue at local level and also at national levels. So I think that local politicians do need to, of course they want to be re-elected, obviously, but they also want to be there speaking up for the values that they and their diverse parties represent. And sometimes, you know, at the moment you could be thinking, well, where are the values in a lot of that sort of centre-right and centre-left politics?
But may they also be thinking, these are not the values that my constituents want? I mean, my constituents may be saying, We don't want to take our fair share, as it is described. Well, we don't feel that we have a European commitment. If that's the case, it's very hard to convince them that altruism is better than their own personal self.
Well, that has been a very, very sad day for this country, if that is the case. And I would have thought that there are politicians in there who I know very, very well, who don't share that view and who do stand up and who do speak about it. And you want to think that they will all have the courage to do that and to stick by the values which we say we espouse, which are those of equality, of humanity, of dignity. Our president speaks out very, very firmly. We need our public representatives at local and at national level to do the same.
But do they not face a lot of people who say, yes, we do espouse those values, but we espouse them for the Irish citizenry, not for the people who are coming here, and we are taking in too many people?
But we do have people coming here. We cannot stand, and we must not stand, if we stand up for anything, and if we stand for anything in relation to humanity. We can't stand here and say our doors are closed because we don't have room, we don't have space, we don't have whatever. It is true that there are maybe not particular obvious pull factors, except that generally speaking, across the world, it is known that Ireland is a rich country. In fact, it's one of the...
But we do have a cohort now, and a growing cohort, who are saying exactly that, don't we? Like, we do have a cohort of people who, however we characterise them, their view is exactly as you have described. We don't have to do any more than we have done. We've done enough.
I don't agree with that, obviously, at all. I mean, I think that what I'm saying is that people perceive from elsewhere, perceive that this is a country which has a great deal of wealth. It's in Europe. We're small, but we do have that kind of space. And we're also supposedly a country which believes in equality. But we're, in fact, you know, the danger in Ireland now is that we're becoming a closed doors country. And I think that is abhorrent.
Briefly, Daniel, is any party, do you think, in your judgment, handling this issue well?
Possibly the Social Democrats. They would be one of the few parties in opposition, and the Labour Party you could put in there as well, that haven't decided to kind of swing.
You might look at People Before Profit also.
People Before Profit also, who haven't decided to swing to the right on the issue, because outside of the immediate rights and wrongs of the issue, this is having huge political ramifications, and more so for some parties than others. I mean, if you actually look at the polling, those with the most anti-immigrant views tend to be supporters of independence, who are the most vocal in the Dáil on anti-immigrant views, followed by Sinn Féin, who's probably had the most dramatic about turn on their position on migration, and then followed by the other two main government parties of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. So this will be an issue at the next election, mm-hmm. and you could see some parties try capitalise on it.
If you want to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cents, or you can get us on WhatsApp 087 1400 106. Now, if both of you want to remove the pikes from the thatch, I want to get your view on the New Yorker's piece. This social media has been getting getting his pants in a bunch, is the way to describe it, over this piece done in the New Yorker. The New Yorker published a piece entitled Cillian Murphy's Bedtime Routine. And it runs from 5 p.m. It just goes 5 p.m., 6 p.m., 7 p.m. And it runs through what they say he does in the evening. They say it, I think the term they might use is humorously. They say, call round to the pub and dine on a hearty meal of potatoes, bangers, and the knowledge that you are Christopher Nolan's favourite. Then later, try on various peaked caps while drinking bathtub gin. Select a cap for the evening's bath, throwing others into the peaked cap room. Add Guinness glitter bath bomb to gin. Soak. Carefully polish both magnificently chiselled cheekbones with separate sticks of Kerrygold butter, unsalted. Text Paul Mescal a gif of Bradley Cooper looking sad. Then at 9 p.m, this is a direct quote from the New Yorker, make gentle but furious love to the ghost of Molly Malone.
For God's sake.
And then drift into the kind of deep, peaceful slumber that only comes when one rests one's head in the 32 counties.
Well, really, the New Yorker. I mean, what can you say? It is the silliest, stupidest, laziest, most ridiculous, absolute rubbish.
Get off the fence, Alva.
I knew you would say that to me, Anton. I mean, the only thing they get right there is the cheekbones, as far as I can see. They're right about the cheekbones.
Plus, why would you use unsalted Kerrygold? Let's be clear.
And then they speak they speak Gaelic, and I don't know what not. You know, it really is. I mean, it just, it makes you weep for the United States of America. Yet another reason why we weep.
It does. It's really not even that it's insulting. I mean, like, we certainly are no strangers to searing political satire here in this country, but this is neither searing nor actual satire. It's not.
Oh, well, what about the bit where they say, work on a rap song by alter ego Chilean Murph Dog after crafting multiple sick rhymes about Barry Keoghan's junk? Summon wee fairies to mop brow with sink.
I don't even understand that.
No, that one passed me by a bit.
How this got past the editors of the New Yorker, I have absolutely no idea. I'm also kind of enjoying thinking of Cillian Murphy reacting to it, because Cillian Murphy, you can see the disgust on his face normally when he's being asked, you know, kind of cliched, hackneyed questions by reporters. So, yeah, certainly one he wouldn't be happy
with.
The
thing I found when I read it, though, was normally you have sort of pigeonholes of offence that you can reach into. You can go, there's a particular offence button when an Irish athlete is declared to be English internationally. There's a whole,
yes.
But this one just baffles you. It's just a series of, well, not even sure if they're racist tropes.
I think they got drunk on St. Patrick's Day and sat down, the two of them, and concocted this, that somebody had been feeding them far too much whatever they're drinking, and they just sat down and wrote it off.
Plus, call round at the pub and lean on a hearty meal of potatoes, bangers.
I noticed the bangers. Where did the bangers come from?
A coddle would have been maybe slightly more accurate.
Have you ever used the word banger in anger in your life? Have you ever said, ooh, I'd love a banger?
No.
Absolutely not.
No, we don't have bangers in MASH.
View of View, 53106, it cost 30 cent, or 087-1400-106. And sorry, if you missed the start of that, that is from The New Yorker, ostensibly a reputable publication. Daniel Murray, political correspondent of definitely a reputable publication, that being The Business Post. Thank you very much. Likewise, big thank you to campaigner Alva Smith.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.